We are in chapter 30 of Shmuel Aleph. And David and his men leave Achish and come back to Tziklag. And they find this horrible scene. Amalek attacked Tziklag, and Amalek took away their families, and Amalek destroyed the city. And last time we asked why Amalek attacked, the text was somewhat confusing, because on the one hand, it says they went south and to Tziklag, which makes it sound like they're generally attacking in the area. And in the middle of the chapter, we're going to see, we'll get to it today, sentences 14, 15, that they take spoils everywhere. It sounds like it's about everybody, not just Tziklag. But then on the other hand, in the same text, it's going to say that they only burned Tziklag. So the commentators read it as having a revenge element to it, suggesting that they went to the region in order to find who was attacking them, and they tracked down that it was David attacking them from Tziklag, and then they burned Tziklag. That's Radak's statement, that's Malbim's statement. Abarbanel picks up on this also, it seems. So that's why Amalek attacks. Now, David, after the initial blame by the people, is going to set out to find all the people who were taken. Initially, we said the people blame David for what happened. And really, I think you can break down, I gave multiple explanations for why they blamed David last time, but I think I can clarify it by breaking it down into two units. There are those who contend that the people blame David correctly, either, as Malbim said, because he didn't leave guards for the city, or Abarbanel, because he's wallowing in grief for his wives, and everybody has suffered losses. He should be leading them to get the people back. Or the people blame David incorrectly. So Metsudas David says they're blaming David for trying to go to war beside Achish. And remember, we said, number one, he may not have a choice. And number two, he may be trying to help the Jews by trying to ally himself with Achish. He may be trying to sabotage their plan. So what David was doing was correct. We also suggested maybe they blamed David incorrectly because David keeps talking about Hashem helping him, and therefore they're angry at David because look what happened to our families. Maybe they're angry because he attacked the local tribes, which again was justified, but by doing so he antagonizes them. We gave all sorts of different explanations, including the fact that just people blame people, and that really may be what's at bottom here. The last thing that we did was to ask why God allowed this to happen, and we had three approaches. One approach is that this was just nature. This is what happens. You attack people, they attack you back. And God mitigated it by making sure nobody would be killed. That's one approach. Second approach, Rav Bazak's idea, was that God engineers this as a punishment for David giving the appearance of willingness to fight the Jews, and for David tricking Achish. I'm not a fan of this perspective from Rav Bazak. I don't think that it fits. I don't think David had a choice regarding his battles in joining Achish and the deception of Achish. And Malbim suggests that Hashem engineers this so that David will not go help the Jews against the Plishtim. Hashem doesn't want that to happen. Hashem wants Shaul to lose. So therefore, this is going to be the distraction. That was what we did last time, more or less, on chapter 30. So at the end of last time, I know there were a couple of hands, and we didn't get to everybody. Nanette, we ended up resolving your question by email. Other questions on what we did last time? Susan?
It's more leading up to this and all of this. I'm really grappling with Hashem with disregarding human nature and saying Hashem controlled it. It so contradicts everything about free will. I'm not talking about power. But here, couldn't this just have been David with Achish that, yeah, this is the people, it's a very normal reaction, his soldiers or his politicians. I mean, we would have the same reaction.
Right.
So couldn't we say without, I don't want to be sacrilegious, without Hashem, this could have happened just the same way?
What could have happened?
David leaving, David not being able to be in the fight with Shaul, because if he was in the fight with Shaul, he'd probably protect him.
No. We're not saying that God keeps David from joining the battle. We're saying that God sets up a reason why David will not join the battle. He is
right.
Pulling David away.
Could this story...
Yeah, I mean, you're reading it the way Radak reads it. That's Radak's read. I just don't, Malbim is giving you another way to look at it, but Radak's read is that this is what's to be expected. You attack them, they attack you. That's what we said from Radak.
That's it's better.
Okay. Yes, other questions and comments from what we had done last week? Claudette, you unmuted, or you're... Nope, okay. Okay, then let's go further. So, we now get up to David asking Hashem what he ought to do. And Hashem is going to tell him, pursue Amalek, but not everybody is going to go along. So take a look at sentence 7, please. Vayomer David el Eviasar HaKohen ben Achimelech. David says to Eviasar the Kohen, the son of Achimelech, you will recall Achimelech was the Kohen in charge of Nov. So David says to Eviasar, the son, the survivor of the Kohenim in Nov, Hagisha Naliha Ephod. Please bring me the ephod, or bring me now the ephod, however you want to translate the word na. Vayagesh Eviasar es ha'ephod el David. And Eviasar brings the ephod to David. I thought it was odd that we stressed that Eviasar is the son of Achimelech. We know who he is. We've seen him before. There's nothing new here. So the answer may be, don't get hung up on it. We do this a lot in the Psukim. We keep talking about Avigail being the wife of Naval. Yeah, we mention her. We mention her original husband, referencing the story. We talk about Achinoam being Hayisraelit. Because she is, even though, yes, we already know that. So it could be there's nothing here. It could be that we say it in order to highlight what it is that David is asking him to do, to bring the ephod, and we're highlighting how David received the access to the ephod in the first place. The ephod, again, we've seen before, is a term for the garments of the Kohen Gadol with the Urim V'tumim, this breastplate that's going to communicate messages from Hashem. Rav Amnon Bazak thinks that it highlights how Shaul didn't ask for the Urim V'tumim before he attacked Nov. Not sold on that. Just by invoking the name of Achimelech, who got killed in Nov, you're not pointing a finger at Shaul. I think if you want to point a finger at Shaul, there are lots of fingers pointed at Shaul in this story. I don't think that that's it. To me, that's a side note. Okay. Vayishal David Bashem. So David asks of God, Lemor, saying. Now, there are two ways you can translate the following sentence. We're going to come back to it. I'm just going to translate it one way for now, and then we're going to come back to it. David asks of God, Lemor, Erdof acharei hagedud hazeh, shall I pursue this army? Ha'asigenu, will I catch them? He's asking God, should I go? Will I succeed? Vayomer lo, Redof, ki asig tasig vehatzel tatzil. Hashem says, you should pursue them, you will catch them, you will save your families. Go for it. Vayelech David, so, and like I said, we're going to come back to that sentence. Vayelech David, hu v'sheish me'os isha sherito. David goes, along with his 600 men, vayavo ad nachal habesor, and they came to the nachal. Nachal is often a wadi, this wadi of Besor. V'hanosarim amadu, and the remainder stopped. Who's the remainder? What does that mean, the remainder? David goes with his 600 men to Nachal Besor, and the remainder stopped. As far as I knew, David only had 600 men. So who is this remainder? Gets even more confusing. Sentence 10. Vayirdof David huver bameyos ish. David pursued with 400 men. Vayamdu masayim ish asher pigru me'avores nachal habasor. And 200 men stood asher pigru. Okay, Susan, you have the pink book, right? How does it translate the end of sentence 10? Asher pigru me'avores nachal habasor.
Refrained from crossing the brook Besor.
So pigru is refrained, according to that. Okay, Ricky, in your translation, how does... You don't have a translation with you. Okay, Vanessa, in yours, how does it translate the end of sentence 10 after the 200 men?
David pursued to, wait a second. David pursued together with 400 men, while 200 men remained who were too exhausted to cross the Besor Brook.
Too exhausted to recross the Besor Brook. Okay. Interesting. So something's going on here. The Hebrew word, asher pigru, is not a clear word. We need to understand what that word is. But before that, I need to understand, you've got some people who are not going anywhere in sentence 9, the nosarim, the remainder. And then in sentence 10, you have 200 men, asher pigru. So Rashi, Radak, and Ralbag all believe that the ones who are called the remainder in sentence 9 are the 200 men who didn't go in sentence 10.
Yeah.
However, that's really difficult. Etty likes it, but I don't. And the reason I don't like it is because then sentence 10 is redundant. You already told me the remainder didn't go. Why do I need sentence 10 to tell me the 200 men who didn't go didn't go? I already knew they didn't go. I'm sorry?
Explain why they didn't.
Only if you take pigru to mean that they're exhausted, like Vanessa's book. If I take Susan's, then I don't know that at all. It's very strange. So two other approaches to what's going on here. One, straightforward. One opens up a new lens, and Susan's going to be after us again to include Divrei Hayamim with Shmuel. You'll see. Take a look at source number two first. Abarbanel. V'yoser nachon hu shenomar. It will be more correct to say, more correct than saying that it's the same group who didn't show up in sentence 9 and sentence 10. It's more correct to say, she'im heyos leDavid sheish meyos ish milchama. Yes, David had 600 warriors. Hinei hayuimo od cholim zikeinim unarim v'anashim misharasim shalo yilchamu. David had lots more people who weren't fighters. He had those who were ill. He had those who were elderly. It's not as though David just has 600 warriors and that's who he travels around with. There were others around. There were people who were too young to go. There were servants. Ki iev shar shalo nisharu v'tziklag im ha'anashim, anashim ma k'dei lishmoro, son. He says, you can't tell me that David really just left a city of women and tiny children. Of course there were men there who were supposed to be guarding as well. Vayomer akasuv kan shalach David vaanashav sheish meos ish vayavol kulam ad nachal habesor vaanosarim asherimo milavada sheish meos ish amadu. What it's telling us is David and his 600 men go to find Amalek, and the rest of them, the old, the infirm, the young, the servants, they stayed. Rotzalomer nishu b'tziklag. They stayed in Ziklag. Abar Benel is giving you a straightforward read. I think that's simple. I think that works. However, Malbim opens our eyes to the book of Divrei Hayamim. Take a look, please. Open up your Tanakh to Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12. And look what we learn there. From the beginning of the chapter. Ve'ele haba'im el David litziklag. The following people came to David to Ziklag. Od atzur mipnei Shaul ben Kish, when he was still hiding from Shaul. Ve'hema bagiborim ozrei milchama. These were warriors. They helped with battle. And it goes on to describe them and the weapons that they used, and it gives us names on and on in the chapter. And they're from different tribes. Some of them are from Gad, some of them are from Binyamin, some of them are from Menashe. You see that? You've got all these people who joined David when he was in Siklag. I didn't know that. You have to learn Divrei Hayamim to know that. But Malbim knew that. We criticized Malbim last week because he, what he said contradicted something in Divrei Hayamim. But take a look at this in source number 3. Mivoar, it is explained. Kibo el Tziklag od giborim rabim binyamin umenasha el David. He says, if you just learn Divrei Hayamim, you find out that many more warriors came to them from Binyamin, from Menashe, Bein biyoso atzur mipnei Shaul, whether when he was hiding from Shaul, as it says in the beginning of the chapter, Bein bivo'o im plishtim al Shaul amilchama velo azarum, or when David tried to go with the plishtim for war against Shaul, and then he did not end up going with them. So David has more than 600 men. He had 600 men back in chapter 25 when he was fighting Naval. He had 600 men. So now he has more than that. So these are the people we mean when we say the Nosarim, the remainder, who did not go to pursue Amalek. Why didn't they go? This is terrible. Kilo shavu nishayhem uvnehem shaloha yusham, because their wives and kids weren't there, and therefore they weren't taken captive by Amalek. So we're here to help, but not in that regard. Valze omar v'hano sarim amadu, and regarding them, it said the remainder stayed. Rotzel omar hayoser al sheish meos shenosru, the more than 600 who remained. V'loayu lavaz min hagidud amdu bitziklag, the ones who were not despoiled by the attacking army, they stayed in Tziklag. So Malbim says that our reference in sentence 9 is to these other people who had joined David. And then in sentence 10, we have a different group of 200, Asher Pigru, who refrained, who were exhausted, and now we have to explain that. Yes, Janine.
Doesn't the word pigru also have intimations of death? And death
is yeah.
Like a negative.
Yeah, it does. So that's what we need to know, is what exactly does this word mean? So the word peger, as a word, refers to a corpse. We actually have seen this, but I don't blame anybody for forgetting, because it was back in chapter 17, which means it's something that we saw somewhere around 2 years ago, maybe more. Chapter 17, sentence 46. By the way, you'll note this is week 150 for us on Shmuel. We're closing in on the end of Shmuel Aleph. So if you take a look at chapter 17, sentence 46, this is the trash-talking sequence where Goliath has said terrible things about the Jews and about David and what he's going to do to David. And David responds to him saying, you know, you got all your fancy weapons. I am just here in the name of God. And then he says in sentence 46, Hayom hazeh, on this day, yisagercha Hashem biyadi, God is going to hand you over to me. Vihi kisicha, I'm going to hit you. Vasirosi es roshcha me'alach, I'm going to take off your head. V'nasati peger machanei plishtim hayom hazeh la'of hashamayim ulchayas ha'aretz, and I will put the corpses of the Philistine camp out for the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the land. V'yedu'u kol ha'aretz k'yesh elokim li'Yisrael, and everybody will know there is a God in Israel, says David to Goliath. And that's a term we find many times in Tanakh. We find it with the Meraglim. When Hashem talks about them dying in the desert, he says, Ufig rechem atem. You find it with Avraham at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, the covenant between the pieces, Vayered ha'ayit al ha'pigarim. Those are the pieces of the animals. So the word itself refers to dead bodies. That's what pigarim are. Etty, I'm going to ask you to wait now. The question is, so what does that mean here? And we have three different views. Take a look at source number 4, where I gave you a list, and then we're going to walk through the list. No, Ricky, I'm going to ask you to wait. I'm sorry. If you take a look at source number 4, I want to make sure people hear this first. Rashi says, Peger means one who is inactive. One who doesn't do. Like Susan's translation, they refrained. Pigru, they simply didn't go. They were inactive, just like a corpse is not active. That's one take. The second take, and this is like Vanessa's translation, is in the Targum. It's Rashi brings it as well. Radak brings it as well. And that is exhausted, wiped out. They're like a corpse. That's a second reference for Pigru. And then the third approach, which Abarbanel brings, and Malbim also brings, I'm not sure why I didn't write Malbim on the sheet, I should have put Malbim on that list also, is that a peger is a body. And this was a group of people who remained as a body with a specific task. So we're going to get layer upon layer of meaning. So I know, Etty and Ricky, you wanted to ask or comment something, but I want to go through this first, and then I'll take the comments. So you can write them down, and then we'll come back to you. So first approach is these are people who are inactive. This is a bad read, meaning this says these are people who dropped out. They said, we don't want to go. We're just not going. That's all. Too bad. Rav Bazak builds on this idea with an idea which I think is a little too fanciful, but nonetheless, I mention it because it's an interesting thought. Take a look at source number 5. He's going to suggest that it isn't that there is, you know, an army of 600, and it breaks down that 400 went and 200 didn't go. He says there are actually identifiable units. There's the 400, and there's the 200. And the reason for it, before we read it inside, is we saw ages ago that when David first went out on his own as a fugitive, after his first round with the Plishtim, David starts to gather people to him. He has 400 people, right? We talked about that, how he has 400 men. Fine. Then he is in chapter 25 against Nabal, and suddenly he has 600 men. So that means that he first had 400, and then 200 more joined. So Rav Bazak suggests maybe they're sort of the original David people. And then there are those who joined afterwards, but they're seen as, and they feel like, a separate contingent. Take a look at number 5, please. Ukvar amadnu al kach sheyitachen she'arba meos ha'anashim shalu acharei David, hayu osam arba meos ish shel hagarin ha'mikori. He says, we've already suggested that the 400 men who followed David are the same as the 400 men in his original group. V'hamasayim sheyashvu ala kelim, and the 200 who stay with the equipment, which is what's going to happen here, heim elu sheitztarfu meuchar yoser, those are the ones who joined later. V'haya tosefes shalohaisa migubeshes dayayim hakvutza hamikorit, they were an added group that never really merged with, they never really melded with, that original group. Memela nitan lomar shegam arba hameos shahalchum David kan him arba meos anshei hagarin arishoni beocha masayim anosafim heim heim shenosaru beagaf haafsanaut, which is a new word for me. I didn't know that word before. Gam ba'aliyat al Naval. He says, look, when they attacked Naval, you also had 400 go and 200 remained behind. We talked about this. I discussed this with you previously and gave different reasons for why when David went with Achish, he didn't leave 200 behind. But when he went to Naval, he did leave 200 behind. We talked about that. But his point is to suggest that actually there's a split like this. There's the 400 and then there is the 200 and people have different identities. In a footnote, he acknowledges that you don't have to say that. He says in his Ha'ara, Yitachen kamuvan she'en kesher ben hakvutzot. It's also possible that there's no link between the groups that are here and the groups back in the story with Naval. Uvechol pa medubar banashim shonim. And each time it specifies different men. It's talking about different men. Ela she'im be'emes ein elu shtei kvutzos kvuos, kashe lahavin, mara ha'mikra l'tzayen chaluka zu. But then he says, I don't understand why the text has to go out of its way to say 400 and 200, 400 and 200. it must be in order to teach me they're the same. I am not convinced at all by what he's saying. Nonetheless, the point right now within this school of thought is that, as Rashi brings it, these are just people who choose, I'm not going. This is an important perspective, an important view, because it explains what's going to happen later. Because what's going to happen is, all right, spoiler alert for anyone who has not already read the chapter, because you should have already read the chapter, they're going to win, they're going to beat Amalek, they're going to come back with spoils, and the 400 are going to be angry about sharing with the 200. So if the reason why the 200 don't go is because they don't feel like it, then I understand why the 400 are angry. You didn't feel like going, you get six spoils, who are you? Right? That would make a lot of sense. So that's one approach. These 200 are the dropouts. Then you have the school of thought, also brought in Rashi from Targum Yonah's son. Rashi references Targum Yonah's son on Yechezkel, but I didn't bring it on your sheet. But that is the idea that they are exhausted. There's a word in Yechezkel chapter 30, sentence 4, which says, v'nehersu, to be destroyed. And the Targum Yonasan on that uses the same root of pei gimel resh. The idea is to be exhausted, to be wiped out. And that's pigru. They're just tired. And therefore, they didn't go. That's an approach. Also, actually, not this week's Parsha, but the following week's Parsha, Parsha's Yisro, when the Jews are warned not to go up on Har Sinai, Pen Yehersu, El Hashem Liros, right? So there also, if you look at Onkelos, you see the same root that's used, the Pei Gimel Reish root. There it's lest they destroy. Radak has a similar idea. Ralbag takes this approach, but he gives it a negative spin. He says they aren't exhausted. They just say they're exhausted. Take a look at number 6. V'ulai zeh, v'ulai hayazeh, li'yir asam me'hagidud hahu. Maybe they were afraid of fighting the Amaleki army. Osha yugayim ma'od, or they were really tired. U'kir v'chira oz David zeh, shivam shamad bo'am l'shmura ke'lim. So David said, fine, guard the equipment. But maybe it's that they are exhausted, and maybe it's that they just say they're exhausted. Okay, and within this school of thought, if they really are exhausted, so they're justified, but you can see that the 400 would still be angry. Hey, I'm tired too, you know? But then you get a Barbanel and Malbim, and they take Peger to mean a body, a unit. A Barbanel in source number 7 says, you're missing something here. Let's invoke a little military strategy. There is a wadi here, okay? I'm taking Nahal as wadi, which again it often is. So a wadi is an area that is often dry, but sometimes you get these floods and suddenly it becomes a stream or even a river. So if you've seen pictures of wadis, you know that often there is a steep hill flanking the wadi, right? The water comes down from that in order to flood it. That's what Abarbanel envisions here, is that hill. He doesn't go into the whole discussion of what a wadi is. But look at number 7. He says, V'yidmesh ha'yal oso ha'nachal har gavoa v'talul. You had a high hilly mountain at that area around that wadi. U'mesukan l'ha'avaras am rav banachal. The result is, it will be very dangerous for you to have your whole army crossing the wadi. Because if the enemy comes and takes the high ground on the hill, Barosh Hahar Asher Alav, Lo Yavor Ish Banachal, no one is going to make it across. You need someone to keep the enemy from taking the high ground, or you're going to be cut off. They'll just throw rocks down and destroy them. Upnei zebachar David shamasayim ish yisharu shama ba'oso makom mehahara misukan. So David said, I want 200 men to remain there at that place where you have this dangerous hill, kidei sheyishmeru oso, to guard it. V'yu lahem mivtzar misgav, they would be a fortress. V'lo yavo ha'ivim lihisagev bo, so that the enemy could not occupy it. You follow? That's the idea per Abarbanel. So they are a body. Malbim has a similar idea, not in terms of the high ground and all of that, but he just says, David wants to have someone there to guard the equipment so that they can run quickly after Amalek. He says in number 9, number 8, Shalo Shavulabesam, they didn't go home, this 200. Rak amdu sham bifkudas David, they stood there at David's command, lishmor kelim shehun chusham, to guard the equipment left there, lahakel hatarach, to ease the burden. Right? You can leave your equipment and then you can run much faster. So, three different peger approaches. Dropouts, those who are exhausted, or a military division. Of course, if you take this last view, then you're going to need to ask, so why are the 400 angry at the 200? David put them there for a reason. We'll have to come back to that. That's absolutely a question. Okay, going in order then of those who had been waiting. Ricky, we answered your question. Great. Eti.
Lefoger means to lag behind.
Yeah.
And it's not the same as beggar, which is a dead body.
So I think the problem is you're coming in with modern Hebrew, which often draws on earlier references like this one.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. No, and look, there are other modern Hebrew words with the same root that I'm not going to go into. But there are things that are not nice to call somebody that have pe gimel resh at their root as well. Thank you, Ruth. The idea here is clearly all three of these stem from the classic word peger as a corpse. It's just different ways that you could use it. It's very colorful language.
But it is the verb. It says pigru, not ayu peger.
I know, that happens all the time. In Hebrew, nouns become verbs very easily. All over the place, nouns become verbs. That doesn't bother me in the least. The nouns become verbs, and verbs become nouns, and we're good with that. So, what we have here is David and his men, after the... you're not trying to raise your hand, right? It's just doing it.
I am. I just didn't want to be rude if you...
Okay, when you turn off the hand thing on your own, then I don't know whether you meant it or whether it was an accident.
I'm sorry. There's a fourth, I think, and it may support one of the explanations. Mine's the JPS.
Yeah.
My translation says fate. The 200 were fate to follow David. And in English, faint of heart is actually cowardly.
Right.
And so... it would then be consistent, as you said, spoiler alert, to the explanation why the 400 were, in my translation, says churlish and mean, meaning ungenerous.
Right.
And so they wouldn't want to share with cowards the spoils.
Right, no, that would fit with Ralbag.
That's right. With
Ralbag. Right, although, again, faint, as you know, could just mean exhausted. It could mean exhausted, and it could mean that they also were faint of heart. You could read that either way. They have done an admirable job of choosing an English word that is as ambiguous as the Hebrew.
Mine says faint as well.
Okay, maybe you're using the same one.
So faint that they could not go over the brook.
Okay.
But so faint would be more consistent
with exhaustion.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would agree.
Okay. Yeah.
So David has asked for advice from Hashem. Hashem says, go, you're going to catch them. And and 600 seem to have set out. Some remain, which may be in addition to the 600, others, right? And then you have 200 who remain, whether because they don't want to go, or whether because they are exhausted or afraid, or because they were assigned a specific role. You could read Malbim as suggesting they stopped for a different reason and then they were assigned the role of guarding also. You could legitimately read Malbim that way too. Susan.
I'm going way back when Shaul was fighting and he got in trouble for not using the Urim and Thummim. Way before that.
Yeah, in chapter 13-14, in that war. Yeah.
Yeah, so didn't we, like, this reference again, we don't see him ever using the Urim and Thummim.
Yep, we're going to come back to that.
Oh, okay.
Yep, so you are correct. You are correct. We're going to come back to that. Not today, but we will come back to that point. You're right. So, question. Go back to sentence 8. I have a real problem with sentence 8. Well, my question, I guess, really starts with sentence 7. But here's my problem. Would David really have refrained from going if Hashem said, don't go? Their wives and children are being held captive. You're really like, God, tell me, should we go save our families or not? God says, no, don't go save your families. And David says, okay. Like, that's hard. So I think it depends on how you read this verse, sentence 8. You could read it the way that I read it initially, which is two questions. Shall I go? Will I succeed? However, you could also read it as, I'm going. Will I succeed? Question mark. Let's go with the translations again. Susan, in sentence 8, is it one question or two questions?
In mine, it's two questions, except they give you a note underneath.
Okay, so I don't want the note, because the note is is commentary that I'm going to bring you. I'm sure the note is referencing a Gemara that we're going to talk about, so hold off on that. But your main read is that it's two questions. That's what you have. Vanessa, you have it as two questions. Etty has it as two questions.
I understood it as, and when I read it in Hebrew, that said, I'm going after them. Would I catch them?
So you're reading it as one question, but what does your translation do?
The translation has two questions.
Has two questions.
So let's go
on. Okay. So you really can read it both ways. You can read it as, Erdof, I'm going to pursue. And then the question is, will I succeed? Erdof acharei agedud hazeh. Ha'asigenu, will I catch them? And that, in fact, is how Malbim reads it. Take a look at source number 9. Ani erdof b'chol ofen. I'm going anyway. Ushel asihu ha'asigenu. My question is, will I catch them? Veheshiv, and he answered, Redof. Kitasig, run after them, pursue them, you will catch them. Velotia pula betela, it's not going to be for nothing. Vegam tatzil, and you'll also save everybody. Ve'ata mechuyav lirdof, and therefore you are obligated to pursue. So the read that Malbim brings to this is that it is in fact one question. If it's really one question, you have to ask yourself, look at God's response. God responds saying, Redof, run. If David wasn't asking whether he's going to run, then why do you answer, run? So Malbim explains, because by doing so, God makes it an imperative. Now it's not only an initiative of your own, it's you're obligated to do so. That's one way to read it. However, the Gemara does not do that. The Gemara in Yuma says, and we've seen this before, we discussed this a while ago in chapter 23, was that David actually asked two questions. Do you remember we had this whole discussion there when David is afraid of Shaul, right? You remember this whole thing with it, and he asks, is Shaul going to come to Keilah? And is he, and you know, are the people going to turn me over to Shaul? And is Shaul going to come to get me, right? That whole thing. And we said then that there is a protocol for how you ask questions of the Urim V'Tumim, right? The Urim V'Tumim is not chat GPT. You just type in all the questions you want to type in and the AI gives you a response. The Urim V'Tumim has to be approached with a proper protocol. So one of the rules is you ask one question at a time. And we gave different, you know, points related to that, but that's clear. But if David is asking two questions here, we have a problem. And why does David get a response from God if he asked it appropriately? So the Gemara answers, and Radak and Abarbanel bring it here. Take a look at source number 10. V'im hutzrach hadavar l'shnayim, if the situation necessitates that you ask two questions, machzirin lo shnayim, then he'll get both questions answered. Shneamar, as the text goes on to say. So according to this view, this was, according to the Gemara and Yuma, he actually asked two questions. Yes, you're not supposed to, but it was okay because he was under pressure. He had to move. He had to do this quickly. Clear? Okay. So, the Gemara's view, and the view of most commentators, Radak, Ralbag, is actually that David was asking, should I go? Which means if Hashem said to him, don't go, David would not have gone. That's the upshot of that. That's really remarkable. You know? I mean, does that not strike you as remarkable? Am I just the only one who has remarked?
We see right throughout, David he asked God a lot of times. Like, he has been the basis of God's leadership.
Yep. So it is not for nothing that we introduced him by saying Hashem Imo, God is with him.
So maybe he assumed, he's asking without already knowing that God's going to say do it.
Like, maybe.
I'm asking out of polite, like, because I'm supposed to ask you. That's my job. I can't do it without asking you. But I already know you're going to tell me to go.
But you have to know, Shaila Mach Trey, if you ask the question, you have to deal with the answer. The answer may not be what you want. Etty and then Ricky.
Okay, I'm looking at it, as I said, I read it in Hebrew before the translation that had two questions. And in Hebrew, if he was asking God, am I to run after them, he would have said, ha erdof.
And that's Malbim's, and that fits with Malbim's read. The problem is just then you...
I'm going after them, will I catch them?
The problem is then you have to answer the question of why God says redof if he wasn't asked. What confirming? No, the answer is what Malbim says. Malbim says, God says Radof because he wants to make it obligatory, not just what you choose to do. Ricky and then Ruth.
But it's the answer that I find interesting because David doesn't ask about saving them. And Hashem answer, Radof, the Sikh, the Hatzel, as God knows what David has in mind. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't only give him permission, but he also said, this is what's going to happen.
Right. It is interesting that David doesn't ask about success. I don't know why that is. Ruth.
Isn't this why we revere David so much? Because he had such emunah that if God said to him, no, don't go, he would have listened to him?
Yes. I think that is a major part of why David is David. I agree with you. I still find it remarkable, but yes. Claudette.
What is remarkable because I don't see David leaving his wives in danger. So,
yeah, I mean, I find this whole thing very interesting and very fascinating. The willingness of David to do this, I don't think is straightforward. But yes, it is a trait that we associate with David. I also have a separate problem, which doesn't really fit on this line per se, but it does fit with this situation and with the general passage. This has been bothering me since chapter 15. I must have mentioned it at some point before. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of destroying Amalek. Why does nobody go about it until God tells them to do so or Amalek attacks us first? Shaul knew where Amalek was. Shaul was already melech, right? Why didn't Shaul attack until God said to him, go fight a war against Amalek? In chapter 27, David went to fight Amalek, but it didn't indicate at all that it was because of the mitzvah of wiping out Amalek. He attacked the Geshuri, he attacked the Gizri. We said maybe because they're from the seven nations. Like, nobody said this is a war against Amalek. And here again, David is asking God, these people from Amalek, should I fight them? Like, what do you mean? Open a chumash. I find that very difficult, and I have yet to find anybody who could give me a quality answer, something that really fit. I don't know. It's just something that I'm raising because I think it's a question to contemplate. Nanette and then Susan.
It's one thing that I don't know Hebrew well, so I have a question with respect to that. My translation says, shall I pursue those raiders? Will I overtake them? And there is a difference between the use of words shall and versus may I. So may I is actually permission, whereas shall I is more like a proposal. Is it available to me? Is this something that I can do? And I'm wondering, is it sort of a deferential, it's a deferential way of saying, is this in the cards for me? Shall I? Is this right. A proposal that you can accept? Whereas may I, I'm perched and I'm ready to go.
Right. So the answer, I think, is that it depends on whether you read it as one question or two questions. If it's only the one question of, will I catch them, then it's just a proposal and it's not even that. It's just asking about the future. You know, is this going to, I'm going, am I going to catch them? Whereas if you read it as two questions, he really is asking for permission. And I don't know whether you want to call that shall or proposal. I'm not sure how to break that down, but he's asking for permission for sure. Should I do this? Is this okay for me to do this? You know, that's the way that I would look at it.
Yeah. Shall is to be more deferential. Like, is this something that is available that is in your vision for me? Whereas may I suggest that I actually want to do this. I'm just asking your permission.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You've answered your own question. You've answered your own questioning. You have agency in it. Whereas shall I think, has less agency and puts it in the hands of the chef.
I don't know. Certainly from the Hebrew perspective, if you're saying erdof as a question, you are asking, should I do this?
Okay.
Yeah, that's the way I would read that.
But you said this about Amalek.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that, actually. But then I sort of thought to myself, hey, why David? Since Yehoshua's time, you were supposed to do Amalek. Nobody has done him yet. So
he's not
unusual. Shaul didn't do it his whole reign.
So if I remember correctly, when the Gemara talks about the three mitzvos that are incumbent upon entering into Israel, and they go in order, and I believe having a melech is before wiping out Amalek.
Oh, so the order.
So it begins with Shaul as a command. I seem to remember that. Yeah, no. I mean, Shaul has only been. My question was, why didn't Shaul do it?
Yeah, I thought he was just skating through. They were all afraid. We're afraid of the Plishtim, but maybe there's a bigger fear for some reason of Amalek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked it up now because that's the advantage of doing this on a computer. Yeah, it's first to have a king and then to wipe out Amalek. Sanhedrin Chafa Mabiz. Yeah. Janine.
Just want to say that I read the word erdof not as a, not saying I will and not saying should I, but saying if I do it. Then Hashem made it a commandment as opposed to, you know, told him what to do.
Okay. I mean,
it's a little more deferential to say if I do it as opposed to saying to God,
right.
I'm going to do it. Which
right. I hear you. I hear that as a possible read. So in sum, David asks God whether he will succeed. Maybe he asks, should I go? Not everybody goes to the battle. Whether for bad motivations, neutral motivations, or good reason. I've been assigned. This is my role. Now you get an Egyptian thrown into our story. Aid from an interesting place. I should note, just in general, because it's easy to forget this, it's not strange to have an Egyptian in the story, given the geography. Remember that we're in the area of the Plishtim, right? Amalek is also in that southern region, as we've talked about. And if you just go a little west, you're in Egypt. So it's not so strange to have an Egyptian around. But the story involving him is very interesting. Yeah, Susan.
Just before you do that, after they complained, the third reason, you know, because they wanted to be guarded, would make a lot of sense. Because
because just before that, they're saying, how could you leave us? Why did you do this? They're angry at him. Well, now I'm not going to do it again.
Well, this isn't guarding people. This is guarding equipment.
He's not guarding the people that are left?
No. No, no, no. It's guarding the equipment. You'll see. It's explicit in the text. Okay. So let's see what happens. We are back in chapter 30. We are up to sentence 11. Vayimtzu ish mitzri basadeh. They found an Egyptian man in the field. It's actually interesting. You could read it as the 200 found the Egyptian man, because if you look at the previous sentence, right, the 200 men stood there and didn't cross, and they found an Egyptian in the field. Rabag notes that. I first thought it myself, and then I saw Rabag actually says, you could read it that way, or you could read it that the 400 found. It doesn't in the end matter. Vayikruo so el David, and they took him to David. When I say it doesn't matter, it's Torah. It matters. However, it doesn't change our understanding of the story. Clarified. So, vayikruo so el David, they bring him to David. Vayitnu lo lechem vayochal, they gave him bread, he ate. Vayashkuhu mayim, and they gave him water to drink. Lechem, by the way, does not have to mean bread. You know, in Tanakh, very often lechem means food. Fine. He gets a meal. He gets food. He gets something to drink. Vayitnu lo felach divela, and they also gave him a piece of dried figs. How do you like that? They gave him some they gave him some dessert, ushnei tzimukim, as well as two tzimukim. Now tzimukim are
raisins.
Remember what we said back in chapter 25 when Avigail gave food to David's men. Yeah, jump back for a second, take a look, because we were surprised by this then, and at the time we found an explanation which is relevant here as well. If you look at chapter 25, sentence 18, Avigail brings food. So she brings 200 loaves of bread, ushnayim nivle yayin, two flagons of wine, v'chamesh tzon asuyos, and the five prepared sheep, we talked about that, v'chamesh si'im kali, five sa'ah of singed grain or dried grain, umeya tzimukim, 100 raisins, umasayim develim, and 200 of these develim, and again, develim are some kind of pressed fig cake. So here we get some devela for this guy, and two tzimukim. So we said over there, when she gave 100 raisins, she isn't giving a box of sun-made raisins, right? A box with, you know, well, however many raisins. Rather, the explanation that we gave when we saw that before from Professor Keel was either it meant bunches of grapes that have been dried, so it was 100 bunches of grapes, in which case here it's two bunches of grapes that have been dried, or
the article translation says two bunches.
Yeah, because they're following that.
Matsudas David. In chapter 12.
Chapter 25.
Chapter, what are we doing now? Chapter 30.
Yeah. Yes. No, that's what I'm saying. Matsudas David here also says bunches, but they're basing it on that. The other take that's possible is that these are also cakes of raisins, like pressed raisins made into a portable cake. Either way, it's not two raisins. Just, you know, for reference. Vayochal, he ate. Vatashav rucho elav. And his spirit returned to him. He was starving. Ki lo achal lechem v'lo shasa mayim shlosha yamim u'shlosha leilos. He didn't have bread and water for 3 days. I hope he had some water, because not going, you know, going 3 days without water is hard. But that's the story. The Malbim comments on the medical quality of this treatment for the starving Egyptian based on secular medicine, but also based on the Gemara in Yuma, Pei Gimel. The Gemara in Yuma, 83a, is talking about somebody who is ill on Yom Kippur and needs to eat. And it talks about somebody who has something called bulmus, which in the Gemara, based on a Greek term, loosely associated with bulimia, but not directly, they say refers to somebody who has a strong craving and feels like they have to eat. And the Gemara talks about how you feed them. And as part of that discussion, we also get source number 11. Tanu Rabbanan, the sages taught, Misha achazo bulmus. If somebody is gripped by this bulmus, they have to eat. Ma'achilin oso dvash v'chol mine masika. We feed him honey and all manner of sweets. Shadvash v'chomine mesika me'irin ma'or enav shel adam, because these things illuminate a person's eyes. They'll give him his energy back. Amar Abaye, the sage Abaye says, lo shanu elala achar achila, dessert is after you eat, not before you eat. Avakodem achila migra garir, if you give him this before he eats, it's just going to make him hungrier. Dechsiv vayimtzu ish mitzri basadeh, and he gives the example in our passage where it's bread and water and then dessert, not the other way around. So there. So that's just a side note. But this fellow's been starving. 3 days and three nights, this Egyptian guy. And then he talks. Vayomer lo David. David says to him in sentence 13, Lemi ata ve'ein mize ata. Whose are you? Who are you associated with? Where are you from? Vayomer, and he says, Nar mitzri anochi. I am an Egyptian youth. Eved le'isha maleki. I am a slave to an Amaleki man. Vayazveni adoni ki chalisi hayom shlosha. My master abandoned me because I've been sick for 3 days already. So therefore, he just left me by the side of the road. Anachnu pashatnu negev hakri. See, this is the verse that we referred to before. We, the Amalekite army, we extended ourselves to the southern area of the Krasi. Krasi is a reference to the Plishtim often. Val Asher LeYehuda, and in the Judean area, Val Negev Kalev, the southern area of Kalev. I'm going to come back to that. V'es Tziklag Sarafnu Ba'esh, and we burned Tziklag. That's what he reports to David. So he says, I've been ill, so my master abandoned me. And as we said, the attack was regional, right? It's the whole area. It also tells you that Amalek is not an ally of Achish. We talked about this back in chapter 27, who is David attacking, right? We had a view that said that he's an ally of Achish. Here it's very clear that he's not. They're plundering and they extend themselves in the area of the Krasi. You could argue against what I just said, but I don't think it's correct. But we went to the area, the south of Kalev. So according to Radak, this is a reference to Kalev, like our Kalev, right? The, you know, Kalev ben Yefuneh. And his portion remained known as a unique portion, even though he's from the tribe of Yehuda. That's consistent with what we saw back in Yehoshua and Shoftim. Some of you have been with me since we learned Yehoshua and Shoftim. And you will remember that we saw that Kalev has a separate conquest. And he promises his daughter, Achsa, to whoever will conquer Kiryat Sefer. Right? That whole story, and ends up being Othniel ben Kenaz. My only problem with that is that that's far from here. Kalev's land is on the outskirts of Hebron. So you're in the entirely wrong part of the country for them to have extended themselves Negev Kalev. I don't know what to make of that. But that's what this man tells him. We extended, we despoiled. That's what we've been doing. I mentioned it, but I forgot to specify. Krasi, in a few places, is associated with the Plishtim. I actually thought I had it in my notes, but I don't see it now. But it's a pasuk in Sefania, is one of the psukim that makes that association with the Plishtim. Either way, that's what that is. All right, it's 2:29. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to pause here before the Egyptian leads them to Amalek. But one thing that you think you need to ask yourself, and hopefully we're going to talk about next week, is, why are we getting this whole backstory on the resuscitation of this Egyptian fellow? What are we supposed to learn from it? So God willing, that's going to be part of the conversation next week. Okay?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everyone.